Spider-Man and the X-Men.
Welcome to FW Team Up, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm Siskoid.
And I'm the Irredeemable Shag.
Taking you through a classic superhero team up, Spider-Man and the Uncanny X-Men from the extra-sized Marvel Team Up number 150, cover dated February of 1985. And Shag, look at that sad Spider-Man in the corner box. It's the final issue of the series.
He's got his shoulders slumped. He's walking away from us. The shadows are showing, you know, at his feet. It is a very, very sad Spider-Man. Yes, he's...
I imagine his Peter Parker clothes are in a trash can just off.
Yep. There you go. Yeah, exactly the same pose. You're right. And if I had seen this on the shelves, if I had still been collecting Marvel Team Up at the time, I probably would have been the sad little Shaggy walking away from the convenience store with this in my hand, I bet.
I think I was sad. I just started collecting it month to month.
Oh, gosh.
And as we know, you know, we've talked about this before, you know, the replacement series, Web of Spider-Man. Well, that's not a team up book. So I wasn't that interested at all.
So I did a little searching. I was wondering about numbers and things like that. And I did find some circulation numbers. I mean, I'm not going to quote all these numbers to you guys. But this came from the whatever the little stamp they would put inside the comics once a year that would tell you the circulation numbers and all right. that. So essentially, and this comes from 1982, 1983. That's the last time they had all these books publishing that they're able to pull it. Amazing Spider-Man was outselling Marvel Team Up and Spectacular Spider-Man by about 36%. So obviously Amazing was doing really well, and Spec and MTU were kind of neck and neck. And so I can only guess that a year after those numbers, Marvel Team Up must have been slipping even further, right? And Marvel figured that another Spider-Man book, kind of like Spectacular, would sell better. And essentially they were right. I mean, Web of Spider-Man started off incredibly strong. It was selling much better than the Spectacular. Eventually, it did settle into being sort of the third best-selling Spider-Man book. Your opinion on how well it read is entirely up to you, but I think there's a general sense out there. But anyway, I still think Web was probably selling better than Marvel Team Up would have done at that point.
Yeah, I think it's the novelty of it. You know, a new number one, and it's like when a new restaurant opens in town, there's lineups for the first few weeks.
Yep.
Even though the restaurant may be very poor. Same thing with comics, and that's why Marvel jump into a new number one very often. DC's the same. I'm not saying.
Well, this was a little different in that they didn't, you know, they didn't just say Marvel Team Up number one. It wasn't the same book relaunching. But yeah, they'll go for a number one as quick as they can, certainly.
Right. And in this case, I mean, ending on a bang in terms of sales, because, you know, that must have been a shift, because the X-Men on those same little boxes were routinely selling in the 600,000 range.
Right.
Which is like three times what Amazing Spider-Man would be doing.
It's interesting that they pulled such big stars in for this final issue. And then, according to the information I read, I guess this is Louise Jameson and Greg LaRocque. And according to what I read, Web of Spider-Man is also Louise Jameson. I'm saying Jameson. Louise Simonson and Greg LaRocque. That's interesting.
Yeah, not to be confused with Louise Jameson, who is
Leela from Doctor Who, which only you and I and four other people know right now. So it's just sort of interesting they kept the same creative team with the launch of Web. So
it's like they gave the job to these people, or maybe it's like, well, can you finish this off before you start on the next series, which we've already contracted you to? I don't know.
And I don't know if she hung around. I mean, I could Google it right now, but it'd probably ruin my internet connection.
I thought like Web kept changing creative teams, or
that's what this book did.
Well, yes, exactly. It's true.
So it would make a lot of sense.
All right. Well, it is the X-Men. Let's preface with reasons why we like these guest characters. What's so great about the X-Men?
For me, a lot of it is nostalgia. All right. So it's like I first heard of the X-Men. You're going to get a little bit of backstory here, but I won't go too long. I first heard of the X-Men in February 1984. The only reason that matters is because that was also when I picked up my very first superhero comic as a collector, which was Secret Wars, the first volume, number two. My first step into the larger Marvel universe was very exciting, and there was the X-Men. And so that was where I got introduced to them. To be fair, I may have seen them on Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, which was the year before, when, you know, Thunderbird turns into a bear for no apparent reason. I'm not entirely sure, but either way. And the important thing was, like, prior to that, in middle school, I'm like the reverse nerd. Most nerds got bullied for reading comics, right? I was actually bullied into reading comics. It was very strange. So I'd ride home on the bus with my friends, and they would be regaling me with these amazing tales of the X-Men and all these stories that they heard. You know, they tell me about the Dark Phoenix saga. They tell me about the Morlocks and Storm losing her powers. And they just, these were like epic legends that became like mythology to me. So I always wanted to buy X-Men, but I was scared to, because I'm like, oh, where do I start? So finally, I buy myself an X-Men issue, Uncanny number 196. It was 1985, because it was a Secret Wars 2 crossover. That was what did it, and boom, I was in, right? I mean, first of all, that issue is just full of dealing with racism and all kinds of really powerful issues that the X-Men are so good at tackling. And what grabbed me was that these comics, they felt different than other superhero comics. I mean, they were tackling real-world issues. They weren't beating up super bad guys. They were dealing with racists. They were all overly angsty. They were heroes that were hated by the general public. They were the underdogs. These were rarely went right for the X-Men, right? And to me, at the time, these comics felt more mature. I felt like they were speaking to me. Now, reading them nowadays, I would not put a mature reader's label on. It's not what I'm saying. But it felt like Claremont had a way of speaking to the reader that didn't make them feel like little kids. Though I started buying from 196 forward. I bought a crap ton of back issues. I filled in essentially most of my collection from either actual issues or the classic X-Men reprints. So, and I kept collecting for 10 more years, all the way to 1995, well into the 300s. So essentially, within those 10 years, I read 20 years of X-Men, because my collection went all the way back to Giant Size X-Men number 1, or at least reprints of, and went forward all the way through, oh good lord, the Phalanx Covenant. Woo, oh joy, in 1995. So between those X-Men books and then all the spinoffs, right? Like, you know, X-Men, Uncanny X-Men, New Mutants, X-Factor, X-Force, Excalibur, whatever. I counted up. I had close to 500 issues of comics that were X tie-ins. So probably my biggest fandom at the time. I mean, honestly, maybe it's still my biggest fandom. I don't really know. I think I have more Superman, maybe. I don't know. Either way. And over the past few decades, I've dropped back in from time to time. When Marvel Unlimited makes it really easy. So, like, I read some of the Bendis era when they were, like, teenage X-Men in modern day, or Claremont's Return in X-Men Forever, and just other random, like, a Nightcrawler being a series, I'll read that, whatever. I did try the Hickman run, Jonathan Hickman run. I did. I read, like, I don't know, like 12 issues of it. It just wasn't for me. It quickly became impenetrable, and I just couldn't care. So I haven't read any new X-Men books in years. I still consider myself an enormous X-Men fan, but for my era, which is like 1975 through 1995. So what about you?
I mean, we're very similar on this, even though the timeline doesn't exactly sync up, because it was the first series I actively collected.
Okay.
Perhaps the only one that I ever got over 100 issues of Uncanny itself. And that's if you don't count like reprints, because eventually we had classic X-Men, right?
Exactly.
And so a lot of the earlier stories, the ones I'd missed, I read through classic.
Yeah, same exact thing here.
I felt like I had everything from Giant Size number 1 to whenever I quit. What's enduring for me, it was better integrated into the Marvel Universe in the 80s when I was reading it, but it's still mostly its own world, sometimes to the point where it feels like a different Earth. They're going through things that the Avengers aren't really going through.
Right. No, very true.
Like, they're going to their own little countries, and there's political events. Mutant hysteria doesn't seem to be on every corner in the rest of the books. I mean, so that isolation means that you can really get into the X-Men and ignore the rest of the Marvel Universe. And of course, it also means the opposite. So when X-Men started, like for me, that's what happened. When X-Men started spawning too many books to count, that's when I bailed.
Oh, okay.
You know, I've returned from time to time. The Morrison run, for example, or recently I've been checking out Age of Revelation, because it's so standalone. You can easily, you know, decide which parts you're going to read. But of course, in the 90s, I dropped out of Marvel entirely. And the X-Men were kind of, it was like the last title I gave up on because, you know, I had like 120 issues or something, not counting all the classic X-Men. So it felt like an entire run from the 70s on, basically. So the X-Men were very important to me as well.
Sounds like we did the exact same thing, using classic X-Men to fill in our collections and say, well, it's a complete collection. It's just, you know, a matter of whether it was a real issue or a classic X-Men. Yeah,
exactly. Let's talk about that publication history. May God have mercy on our souls. We're going to do this very, very briefly, folks. You know who the X-Men are. Come on.
I don't know about you, but I'm gonna give a dissertation on each version of X-Force and each version of X-Factor and
excellent.
X-Factor X and X-Man and all those.
In that case, I will do each single X-Man have his own bio, his or her own bio.
Now let's talk about Marrow.
Yeah, exactly. Obviously, it's a Lee Kirby creation. They premiered in their own title back in September of 1963. They appeared in the Marvel Superheroes cartoon show, but they were called the Allies for Peace.
Really? I didn't know that. Okay.
Mutant sales lagged behind the rest of Marvel's output. So in 1969, Roy Thomas and Neil Adams rejuvenated the book with new characters, like Havoc and Polaris, but it didn't help, and the title started publishing reprints between number 67 and number 93. Then, watershed moment. Giant-sized X-Men number 1 in May of 1975. Len Wein and Dave Cockrum offer a whole new batch of international mutants who would go on to be superstars. The book is relaunched as an all-new and all-different. You know, they continue the numbering, of course. Soon written by Chris Claremont. And it starts to sell like gangbusters. Especially after John Byrne and Terry Austin team up on the art in the 80s. There probably isn't a better selling title on the stands at this point, with Wolverine being singled out for solo stardom and a solo title, and at the dawn of the miniseries format, many X-Men related stories as well. Not to mention the New Mutants, X-Factor, Excalibur, let's not forget Excalibur.
Yeah.
Alpha Flight can count too, I believe. It is a spinoff from the X-Men.
Absolutely an X-Men spinoff, absolutely.
So the Dark Phoenix saga, Days of Future Past, the graphic novel God Loves, Man Kills, they all become instant classics.
Don't forget that seminal moment I mentioned earlier where Thunderbird turns her into a bear on Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. And then, Pride of the X-Men. Come on, everyone loves Pride of the X-Men.
And it may be that the first time I ever saw the X-Men was on Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. That may be my first recognition of the X-Men.
Want a piece of fruit, mate?
Artists like John Romita Jr., Mark Silvestri, and Jim Lee become fan favorites, some of them going on to found Image Comics later with their off-brand takes on the X-Men. We're talking about an incredibly influential series. But then Marvel would get greedy. But that's how I'm putting it. But I'm letting you go through the 90s. I'll go get a drink.
Do I really have to do this? So, all right. So 1991, right? It hits like a mutant-powered bolt of lightning, all right, with a brand new monthly series. And the whole point of it is to be a vehicle to showcase Jim Lee. And it's simply called X-Men number 1. And to this day, Guinness Book of World Records still recognizes X-Men number 1 as the single best-selling comic book of all time. 8.2 million copies were sold. Oof.
Wow.
So I guess I'm not selling those and getting my kid to go to college. Oh, well.
There must be many in the market. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh, dude. There's just long boxes sitting in people's garages. 3 issues into this new series, and unfortunately, Chris Claremont is pretty much forced off the book. You know, after 16 years of writing X-Men and making it, you know, one of the juggernaut properties for Marvel, really, or at that point, the juggernaut property for Marvel, Claremont goes out with a whimper rather than a bang. And the X-Men, surprisingly, they still continue to top the charts, even without Claremont, for years and years and years, with a variety of main books and spin-offs and major crossovers and constant creative team changes. And while they were top-selling books, I think it's fair, everyone would agree that the quality of the storyline had changed dramatically without Claremont. Certainly, there were some standout storylines. I mean, Age of Apocalypse is beloved for all the right reasons. Peter David's X-Factor was excellent and things like that. But the majority of 90s X-Men and spin-offs are, you know, extreme fodder for the 50-cent bins, really. So then, in 1992, and I'm not going year by year, but 1992 is a big moment because that sees the debut of the X-Men cartoon. This is the start of Wolverine and the X-Men becoming well-known outside of the circles of comic book fandom. The cartoon pushes the X-Men with popularity like action figures, tie-in merchandise, you know, birthday party stuff, whatever. Then after that series ends, you know, there's other X-Men cartoons that follow, X-Men Evolution, Wolverine and the X-Men, stuff like that. Jump forward to the year 2000, you know, we've already talked about the comics, but here we see the debut of the X-Men movie franchise. And if the 1992 cartoon started to popularize X-Men outside of the comics, then the movies make the X-Men and Wolverine household names. I mean, my 81-year-old mother knows who Wolverine is nowadays, okay? Shockingly, you know, these movies are still being made today, 25 years later. We just had Deadpool and Wolverine in the theater, right? I think it's reasonable to say that outside of Spider-Man and the Avengers, that Wolverine and the X-Men are the most high-profile Marvel characters. Someone could argue it's Deadpool because he seems to be everywhere right now, But really, A, he's a subset of the X-Men. And B, once you remove all the teenagers and the Hot Topic shirts, I think the general public knows the X-Men and Wolverine better than Deadpool.
I would agree.
Now, going back to the comics, you know, there's a lot of runs to the 2000s that are worth noting. You mentioned Grant Morrison. You know, him and Frank Quitely had a huge run that really shook up the series and really made a lot of changes. Then Joss Whedon and John Cassaday come in, and theirs was more of a retro take, but it was also insanely popular at the time. Or Brian Michael Bendis, you know, over in the House of M story, he removes the powers from most of the mutants in the world, which the X-Men had to deal with those consequences for years. Or that Jonathan Hickman, that massive franchise-wide story, most people call it the Krakoa era, you know, that really pushed the mutant storyline just about as far as you can go. And still, Marvel, I would say X-Men are still a powerhouse franchise for Marvel and the movies. And more than likely, the MCU movies are staging everything for a relaunch. Once Hugh Jackman stops cashing those checks, I imagine they are ready to relaunch the X-Men in a heartbeat. And honestly, for the first time, I'm pretty sure, you know, we've been doing the show for a couple of years now, at least my segments. I think this is the first time I've been able to do the entire history off the top of my head. I just had to fact check a few things, about 5% of it, but the rest of it I knew off the top of my head, man.
Wow, okay. You know, after Krakoa, because I'm reading it now, they split everyone up into different teams doing different things. But right now, it's all on hold because they're in the middle of an event that takes place X years from now, clever. And it's another alternative X future, basically, unless Cyclops can undo it, you know. But I'm enjoying it. Age of Revelation, I'm enjoying it. I like Elseworlds, I like What Ifs. It kind of feels like that. Like I said, you can just pick it up anywhere. And I don't feel particularly lost because you're supposed to be lost.
Yeah.
You know, what happened in the years that we missed, you know? But it always feels like that when I pick up some X-Men. So I'm like, what happened? This is the last time. I don't recognize anything.
Every once in a while, they'll decide to go, like, iconic, and they put together a team, which feels a lot like the classic Uncanny X-Men, and like, that's the book I'm going to read.
Right,
and
exactly.
I'll read that on Marvel Unlimited for a while.
But right now, I feel like when they split them all up, it feels a little bit like the early 90s, where, okay, we're gonna have a couple of name X-Men and then a bunch of newbies or strange ones.
Gotcha.
And there's like different books, right? Remember that? So,
oh, yeah.
Kind of feels like that. All right. Well, you know, let's get into this comic. We'll get to talk about X-Men some more, but also Spider-Man. Let's start with the cover by Barry Windsor-Smith. I will tell you right now, I'm not a fan of this cover. I love the corner box. Obviously, it's well drawn. It's Spider-Man and the starring X-Men in this book, Rachel Summers, Nightcrawler, Rogue, and Colossus, and they're just standing there, sort of a static pose, and it says, "And now a moment's silence before the action begins," which I kind of feel is almost added on to promise something to readers who might think this is a little boring, you know? I don't know. It's Colossus is hiding, is protecting his nuts. Nightcrawler is standing really tall rather than being crouched. Spider-Man has his arms crossed. This one doesn't do it for me.
It is weird. Both Rogue and Rachel have their hands in their pockets in very baggy coats, you know, sort of thing. And yeah, and Cyclops and Nightcrawler holding their hands. It is strange.
Are they at the funeral?
I mean, yeah, it's kind of what it looks like. It's Barry Windsor-Smith drawing people the way Barry Windsor-Smith does. So like Rachel looks fine, but like Rogue looks completely off model. The thing is, you know, Barry Windsor-Smith famously drew the Life Death issue of X-Men, which is only about 4 months before this.
Which has a cover like this.
Yeah, and he's a big deal at this point, so I can see why they would have tapped him for it. But it looks to me like he just turned in like a boring pinup, you know, and they kind of were forced to turn it into a cover. And given it's the last issue, I don't know if they really even cared, right? I mean, it's like, we got to get this done just to get to Webb, and that's going to be an amazing Charles Vest cover, so let's get going. You know, I feel like the editors got the art, and they were forced to add that caption box just to explain why the cover's so boring.
The Life Death cover is great. It's more painterly. It's got a better background. This one has just like a purple wash, but it's Storm and Forge, and it's kind of a pose kind of like this, you know? It's like a quiet pose.
Yeah.
Which you don't see a lot of on comic book covers, so I respect that. And for Life Death, one of the seminal Storm stories, that made sense. Here,
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you summed it up pretty well. So instead of belaboring the point of this kind of boring cover that you guys can Google or see on our website or whatever, I'm going to talk a little bit about what's going on at the same time here. Because like on the shelves, the same month as this issue is Uncanny X-Men number 190, which is the kooky Kulan-Gath storyline where New York turns into like Conan's times. And I actually discussed this story on a Once Upon a Geek episode just a little while back, so that's kind of cool. I really like it. So, and then Louise Simonson wrote this story. So when you look at these X-Men, again, Rachel, Nightcrawler, Rogue, Colossus, It's kind of an odd match, but I think what's happening is, you know, she was the editor on X-Men for years, until about 6 months ago. So I think she's trying to be faithful to the current book, because in the current X-Men book, Cyclops is gone. He's in Alaska with his wife, Madeline Pryor. Storm's lost her powers, and she's trying to find herself. Professor X is walking again, and he's busy teaching college. Kitty and Wolverine are in Japan for the Kitty and Wolverine miniseries, which is so weird. Like, they remove Kitty and Wolverine because they're off doing something else. Could you imagine an era nowadays where they would just remove a tentpole character like Wolverine from every other comic because he's got a miniseries at the same time? Seriously? You know, like, yeah. Or not put him in a team-up book that somebody else, who cares about continuity? Whatever. Wolverine appeared in every book. Anyway, it's just kind of funny that, you know, they say, oh, sorry, he's in Japan, you can't use him. So, of course, we're left with these characters, which it's kind of an unusual subset of X-Men. And Rachel, at this point, had only been living with the X-Men for about 2 months. I don't think any of the other characters even knew she was Scott and Jean's daughter from an alternate future yet.
Doesn't even have a costume.
Right. And Rogue has only been on the team for 18 months. It's hard to think of Rogue as a new-to-the-X-Men character. But she was still at this point.
At the same time, it's probably good that they restricted the number of characters.
Yeah, I mean, it does make it a little easier to juggle it all.
Let's get into the issue itself. We don't sound very enthusiastic, but I did like the issue. So.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. It's called 'Tis Better to Give. It is written by Louise Simonson with art by Greg LaRocque and Mike Esposito. It's Black Tom's birthday, and his best friend Juggernaut gives him the Ruby of Sitarak as a gift, making Tom an unstoppable juggernaut himself, or half a juggernaut because they're sharing the power. Spider-Man and some of the X-Men fight them until Tom loses the power. Juggernaut reacquires it, and then the villains escape together. Well, at least Peter Parker finally shot pictures Robbie Robertson wants to publish.
Right.
Basically the subplot. So that's what happens in the issue, but we're going to get into it a little more deeply. And let me start with a weird, you were saying earlier, it's like, oh, editorial was just going, well, whatever, let's get it out. I wonder if this was originally not the last issue, because there's a weird numbering thing. Pages 1 to 21 are numbered as normal. Then it goes an extra length. And as of page 22, they aren't. And it doesn't say the end at the end either on the last page. It's like the letterer didn't get to all those pages or something. I don't know. Because it wouldn't make sense to be cut in half. Because by page 21, the X-Men have appeared, but they haven't been with Spider-Man. So that wouldn't have worked as a team-up issue. So right. This has to be double-sized from the beginning. I don't know. It's very, very strange. Maybe they would have gone, you know, Spider-Man versus Juggernaut as the first issue, and then with the X-Men in the second issue, in 151, for example.
Well, I was going to say, it could be another team inking it, last rush job, because it could have been like, you know, they're trying to get it done. Greg LaRocque was struggling, and so somebody else came in, you know, a many hands kind of inking situation, and so they didn't bother with the page numbers once they got to a certain point. Could be that too. I want to point something out. You specifically said there was no the end, and you're right. I mean, I double checked the copy on Marvel Unlimited. I double checked the physical copy. Nothing. The story just has a final panel. You go to the letters page, and there's not even usually at the end of a series, they do like a big editorial about it, like the history of Marvel Team Up or something. None of that.
Yeah, or thank yous, or yeah.
Just this little tiny editor's box at the bottom of the page where normally you'd get like next issue. It's called the post-mortem department, and it's telling you that Marvel Team Up is over and to go pick up Web of Spider-Man in 6 weeks is basically what it's saying. It's just like so, like you think that they would have made a bigger deal. Now, I didn't spend a lot of time looking at the physical comic. Maybe there was a house ad for Web of Spider-Man in there. I don't know. But it's very strange how they didn't make a bigger deal about go buy Web of Spider-Man now.
Well, I have the physical copy.
Okay.
And let me flip through quickly. I don't even know what the house ad does look like. There's no house ad in here.
Okay.
For that.
So weird. You think, again, you would make a bigger deal if you want to sell your crap.
It's almost like this was a plan that like they came up with last minute.
I feel like Webb was in the works for a while. I feel like they knew they wanted to do something with the Black Costume. We're off the reservation here, but I feel like they wanted to do something with the Black Costume, and they wanted to make it a big deal when they did it. So I feel like they knew what they were doing. And it does feel like Marvel Team has been sort of just spinning its wheels during these last couple issues.
I suppose. And in this case, I think this issue spins a lot of wheels. Because we're not going to get the X-Men for a while. Heads up. At first, we're with Peter. He's broke. He's having trouble with the rent. There are bathing beauties on the roof next to his spider hatch.
Right. He can't slip out of his apartment because there's like a bunch of hot chicks in bikinis.
So there's this whole subplot with the landlady and all of this business. What do you think of this this setup? Because it is following up from the previous issue where Peter's pictures weren't getting bought, and so he's having trouble. The issue will end with him selling pictures. So there, you know, it's part of the arc. But what do you think of it?
Well, I think it works well. I mean, it's Peter Parker. He's got the worst luck, right? And the worst luck here, which makes it funny, is Peter can't get out of his apartment as Spider-Man because there's gorgeous women outside his window. So, you know, it's not a supervillain. It's just some funny, clumsy situation he gets stuck in. So it feels very Spider-Man. He can't pay his rent. He wants to buy Aunt May a gift. By the way, Peter's too poor to buy Aunt May a gift. Is that always a plot point or just in the Spider-Man comics I read? Because I feel like it's in every Spider-Man comic I read. I don't know.
Either deserves a gift or she's in the hospital.
Okay, so it is everybody. Okay, every okay. I do think it's sort of funny with the bathing beauties. He's complaining about these bathing beauties, right? Because, like, you know, every one of us would be like, well, I mean, that'd be the greatest thing ever. But he does suggest he's got all kinds of girl troubles with Mary Jane and Black Cat already. So maybe he's just overwhelmed with attractive women at the moment. I don't know.
Right.
But I think we both have something to say about his apartment. I'll let you go first because you got your notes done first. Let's put it that way.
Well, they give us a shot of the apartment. And what a weird decoration style. It's a nightmare. It's a nightmare because he's got a mounted fish. He's got a fat Buddha. He's got a cigar store Indian.
Let's stop right there.
Well, yes, I was going to stop there. Because
the giant wooden Indian? I assume he's giant. He's in the foreground. Maybe he's not actually that big. But, like, the wooden dime store Indian? Like, what the hell is that doing in his apartment?
Real college student vibes, I guess. You know? Like, he's thinking, some of the things he's thinking is, like, Aunt May is angry at him because he quit college.
Yeah.
If this were a college student's apartment, instead of curtains, you'd have beer posters or, I mean, that's what would happen if he went to school here.
Sure.
Basically. But it's kind of like all sorts of weird junk.
Yeah.
That doesn't like match Peter Parker's personality or anything. Like he should have pictures, you know, like, he should have just like stuck pictures on the walls. He's a photographer, you know, something like that.
He should have newspapers and magazines everywhere too.
Right.
The mounted fish is so weird too. Cause like, I can't help but think, but a few years after this, that would have been like the Billy Bass singing fish is what that would have been on his wall kind of thing.
There's also like something that might be some sort of weird microscope or something, I don't know, on the table, which makes sense for Peter if that's what it is.
That's a lantern.
Oh, it's a lantern.
It's a camping lantern.
Okay, he's got he's got a camping lantern on.
Cisco almost dropped an F-bomb. He's so upset.
And then next to it is a fishbowl.
Yep.
And you just know that fish is, you know, those fish, if there's like two dots, those fish are going to die. I wouldn't trust Peter Parker, Spider-Man, to feed the fish on a regular basis.
Or change their water or anything like that.
Or anything.
He's also got what appears to be maybe a bottle, or maybe it's a wine bottle, I don't know, but with a candle shoved in it next to the TV that is clearly melted quite a bit. Like he's lit the candle and wax has all run down the bottle.
It's very bric-a-brac. Greg LaRocque just like drew his own apartment or something. It's weird, but it's consistent from panel to panel. You know, that's anyway, it's a detail, but it's an amusing one.
I will say Greg LaRocque draws the women fairly attractive.
There's no question there. cut to what here they call above an Asian jungle, and Juggernaut is going to jump out of a plane, crash down on some army guys. I mean, he's going back for the Jewel of Sitarak, and he's got his own action. You could make the case that Juggernaut gets all the best action in the book.
Oh, that's fair. I hadn't thought of it that way, yeah.
When he's smashing tanks one on top of the other, and you know, he's pretty cool. That's why this could be a Spider-Man and Juggernaut team up. Or it's a Black Tom and Juggernaut team up. But the comic is kind of confused because the temple is supposed to be in South Korea, according to the lore. So the communist uniforms that they're wearing are wrong. So maybe it's North Korea. I would allow it. It's just Korea, North Korea.
Yeah.
But then it would be just forests, not jungles. They seem to have a confusion between Korea and Vietnam. Korea doesn't look like a jungle.
I'm not sure Marvel was incredibly sensitive to Asian culture through the 80s, so I wouldn't try and think too hard about this. I think it's sort of adorable that he flies all the way to Asia to get Black Tom a birthday present. Like, it's an insane plot point. Like, how long, looking at that type of plane, how long did it take him to get there? You know, and could have took forever. It's good as 2 weeks. I don't know. And then leaping from the plane, I did like that. That was fun. And there's a fun quote. One of the guys looks up and says, "Up in the sky, sir. Is that a bird?" I mean, clearly, he's some Superman riff going on there. Yeah. And they did also set up the struggle or the strife between Juggernaut and Spider-Man quite well. I mean, Juggernaut has got a Claremont-level exposition thought balloons here, setting up his just general hatred for Spider-Man, which is great.
Last time he showed up at all in comics, it was Amazing Spider-Man 230, which is referenced here. And he was left for dead under a building.
There are so many editor's notes in this issue. Like, this is, as a kid, this is the kind of crap I loved. Because I'd be like, oh, you know, that happened in, you know, Amazing Spider-Man number blah, blah, blah. I have to go read that issue now. Like, I would go and seek out the editor notes issues. Like, this one, they reference Spider-Man issues. They reference Peter Parker issues. They reference Spider-Woman, reference Secret Wars. I mean, there's just a million editor's notes in this thing. It got a little bit overwhelming after a while.
Am I imagining it? But wasn't Juggernaut the villain in Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends when the X-Men showed up? Or was it in a different episode?
He definitely was in Pride of the X-Men. Didn't he come smashing there like, "Dear stepbrother"? He kept saying to Charles. So that's either in Spider-Man's Amazing Friends or it's Pride of the X-Men. I think it's Pride of the X-Men. I don't know.
I didn't watch Pride of the X-Men.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. And I remember Juggernaut in a cartoon. That would be the first time I ever saw him. So
we'll call it Spider-Man then.
Maybe people know.
Perhaps someone should write it in the comments, because writing into the comments of this show is very important.
And that's why we purposefully either make mistakes or seem confused about things.
Just so we can be corrected and get more comments.
Of course.
Plus two is five.
It's a lure. Back to New York. Peter gets, you know, like, he was kind of ignoring these girls, but when they see that he has a camera, hey, you know, you want to take pictures of us? Are you dreaming, Peter? They're also offer him food and...
Right. That's the best thing of it. He's not getting paid money to take pictures of these girls. They're giving him food and chocolate cake because they work at a restaurant. And he's like, hell yeah, let's do this.
It'll come back later. Cut to the danger room. Maybe the scene is surplus to requirements, seeing the X-Men train, but it does show the reader who doesn't know anything about the, you know, it's a team-up book. You're reading it for Spider-Man. You don't know the guest stars. It'll show you what their powers are, what they can do. So I think that is a good idea to fit this in as a sort of introduction to these X-Men.
Oh, absolutely. No, it does a very good job of explaining the powers and the limitations of Colossus, Rogue, and Nightcrawler. It does a really good job there. The only flaw in this is, though, that, like, it's page 10 before the X-Men show up. I mean, goodness gracious, come on. And it is sort of funny to think that people are learning about the X-Men through this book when X-Men are selling, what, did you say, six times as many as this comic or whatever?
The philosophy back then was every comic is some kid's first comic.
Yeah.
And so we have to over-explain things, it seems, for old dogs like us.
LaRock's got some wonky anatomy in this thing, man. Like when Colossus first shows up on page 10, it's like, just don't look at his body too close.
Yeah, he's weird there. It's a frequent LaRock problem. It's like inconsistent. The one X-Men that's not training with them is Rachel, although her head does appear telepathically, so you sort of know what her powers are. You know, she's cooking for them. You see some of the telekinesis used on the food. Louise Simonson must have been hungry when she was writing this this book, because it's like every superhero is eating. I bet Juggernaut's famished.
Maybe. I will say, though, there actually is a precedence for X-Men characters making lunch. Like, I remember... I can't name the comics or whatever, where, like, the X-Men would be training the danger room, someone else would be making lunch. And I know for a fact that was used as a plot point in the TSR role-playing module, Breeder Bombs, for the X-Men. Like, literally, one character is making lunch for everyone else while they're all in the danger room. So, I mean, there is a precedence here.
The fact that they live in a mansion and they're sort of a family just lent itself to that, but I can't believe this guy, sort of very same scene is also in a role-playing module.
I know. Isn't that crazy?
I kind of love it. A superhero has to make lunch for the others, you know? It's like... It's a fun bit.
And I just noticed, like, everyone's got little TV trays because they're sitting down in front of a TV. Like, how strange that they go to the effort to make this meal so they can all sit around a TV together. Like, so weird.
It's very 80s. And then we get some more Spider-Man thinking things, like thinking about footnotes, you know.
Yeah. Louise, she took a good lesson from Claremont here, that's for sure.
We could have had, like, more X-Men material or more team-up material rather than a full page of Spider-Man getting dressed and escaping the girls and...
I just spotted something on page 13.
Yeah.
Peter's reading the newspaper, and you can on the yes. second page, you can see the headline, and they've snuck in Web of Spider-Man as a headline there. Look at that. See?
That's so that's all. The one place. Yeah, that's the one place that they're announcing it is a cameo or an Easter egg.
Right.
Yeah, that's very cool. All right. Well, let's get back to Juggernaut. I've been meaning to do that. He's now back in New York, hotel room somewhere. And he's bringing his gift to Black Tom Cassidy.
But I love that Black Tom is just throwing a party for himself with a bunch of maybe working girls. I'm not sure.
I would say working girls.
Quite possibly.
He's from out of town. You know, he's come down to New York. He's got a birthday party. He's rented a suite.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sexy times.
We should just move on.
Sexy times. And then, of course, the Jewel of Sitarak is the gift, and as soon as Black Tom touches it, he rips out of his clothes, Hulk-like, becomes a Juggernaut himself.
Well, let's talk about this for a second. First off, when Juggernaut shows up, you know, Black Tom's surprised. He's like, Juggernaut, you arrived, but you're still in your costume. Black Tom is wearing his own costume. Why is that a problem? It was just sort of silly. Then, as you said, Black Tom touches the stone of Sycorax or whatever it is and gets all big and ripped. And what also happens, it takes a couple pages for us to realize this, is that Juggernaut has become smaller. But my question to you is, shouldn't Juggernaut's clothes look ill-fitting at this point? Shouldn't like the helmet be like huge on him or something at this point because Juggernaut's gotten smaller?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's unstable molecules. Maybe it's already super tight.
So, whatever. Yeah.
You don't notice that he's shrunk necessarily at this point, right?
Yeah.
We'll find out later. So they don't want to telegraph it. And even when other characters say, isn't he smaller? It's like, I can't tell. He's still big.
Right, exactly.
In the page. But the, Spider-Man saw that Juggernaut was on TV having attacked Korea. And the X-Men are trying to locate Black Tom in the meanwhile. So, you know, everybody's going to converge on this spot, especially once the battle begins and there's like wreckage and you're destroying the city. But the X-Men are taking a cab? No, it's just a car, right?
Nightcrawler's driving.
Yeah, Nightcrawler's dressed as a cabbie.
They say a couple times, it's just going to be a leisurely drive. No rush.
Right, they're just following Cerebro signal to Black Tom, right? They don't expect that there's chaos. Because we only have these four X-Men, I did want to ask you, like, how do you rate these four guys? Are you excited to see any of these people?
Because of when I started, I mean, again, I started 196, so these were the X-Men when I started. For me, obviously Colossus and Nightcrawler mean a lot to me as X-Men characters, which is interesting because both of them leave the book not too long after. I mean, Nightcrawler goes off to Excalibur, Colossus gets in all kinds of trouble in the 90s series and doesn't come back for a long time. So even though all that happens, I still think of them as core X-Men members. Rogue as well. Even though Rogue was newer to the team, she was already on the team when I started reading it. So to me, she's a long-standing X-Men character. Rachel, I have this weird love-hate relationship with. First off, she was there when I first started reading. In fact, 196 was all about her, but I really don't like her as a character. Irritating. She's always whining, just like in this issue, always whining about alternate future and how she remembers things versus how it's playing out. And, oh, my, is Cyclops remember me? Oh, my dad's with another woman. Shut up. But I also get excited when I see her because this suddenly a nostalgia bug goes off. I'm like, oh, that's when I started. So I'm happy to see her until she starts thinking. Yeah. And then it's like, oh, Rachel.
She's also going to go to Excalibur.
Thankfully, she needed to go away.
Only Rogue kind of sticks around.
Of
this group. And I think Rogue is my favorite of all of these. I've always liked Rogue. Nightcrawler, of course. The Swashbuckler, his own miniseries was great. I don't care either way about Rachel. So I don't mind her like you do.
I just think Claremont got too much up into his own continuity and it just got too complicated. And yeah. He didn't have anything to do with her. Like, is she going to be Phoenix? Is she not going to be Phoenix? Is she kind of sort of Phoenix? Or is she really, you know, planet eating Phoenix? Come on, man, make up your mind.
Right. It's like they wanted Phoenix, but they also didn't want to do the Dark Phoenix stuff.
Yeah.
Again, right? And I get it, but maybe it was something that they should have left alone. Anyway, they're the four that we get. They're the four that are going to take a while to arrive at the scene.
Page 27. Page 27 is when Spider-Man and the X-Men finally get together. That's nuts. And by the way, the damage to the city, a lot of it is not even caused by, you know, the X-Men and Spider-Man fighting Juggernaut. It's Juggernaut fighting Black Tom.
Right. Black Tom is initially upset that it ruined his wardrobe, that nothing fits anymore, that he didn't give his consent to be transformed. I get it.
It's like a silly fight and a tremendous amount of damage to the city for a silly fight.
He throws Juggernaut off the hotel. Then he gets thrown off the hotel by Juggernaut. By this point, it's just like just giant holes in the street, you know, exploding buses and or whatever trucks. They're fighting in fire and they don't feel it. When Spider-Man shows up, it's already they're just like throwing cars at each other.
Right.
And Spider-Man does what a superhero should. He takes pictures.
Well, he did that with Cannonball last issue, too. He let Cannonball fight the incandescent man so he could take pictures.
No, he's really desperate, man.
He really is.
And I love like the click whir of the camera, which you can see in other panels when it goes on automatic later. You know, when he finally jumps in.
Oh, good point. Okay.
Yeah, he leaves the camera and you see click whir. And it's important because eventually, because of the smashing, the camera will fall off whatever building to the floor where it also is almost crushed by Black Tom and Spider-Man has to rescue it. Again, this will be important later.
Well, notice when it falls, we keep, like you said, we kept getting click whir. When it falls, we get click clunk. Uh-oh.
Uh-oh. That's not a good sign, but we don't know that yet.
Yeah.
And we're going to get, like, again, X-Men still not showing up. Spider-Man putting up barriers of web, walls of web, and Juggernaut running into the web until Spider-Man kind of trips him up and it slingshots him back into Black Tom. So this is like pretty good action for Spider-Man against two super strong characters.
Right. Yeah, he shouldn't be able to hold his own at all against a Juggernaut, but here he's at least able to not die.
Right. And also using tricks and smarts, he's not going into the battle fists first where he could get hurt. And then Black Tom is also, you know, has his stick, Shillelagh, shooting fire, which is his own power. So Spider-Man gets kind of zapped in the back. And that's when the X-Men finally show up.
Woo! Page 27. Thank goodness.
Yeah, we do get a good example here of Rachel's angst because it's about Juggernaut and Black Tom. They're in the mutant resistance in the future. Can she hurt her past/future allies, Shag?
So frustrating. It's actually in my notes how irritating it is. Like, I get what she's talking about. I don't know that a reader coming in reading this would make any sense of what she's talking about. I don't know if they would.
So there's a missing footnote.
We needed more
thoughts to explain this.
Gosh.
Probably should have just been like, let's not mention it at all.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of continuity conscious stuff in both X-Men comics, but Marvel in this era probably, you know. So the fight is enjoined between now the two villains, the Spider-Man, the teams, you know, everybody's in there. Buildings are falling down. Rogue has to snatch people off the street so they don't get crushed. So we get like a little fighting style from everybody until Rogue does a thing. But what do you think about the fights before that happens?
Oh, they're fine. I mean, you get some great shots. I do love what Greg LaRocque has done with like the building collapsing and Colossus is like saying, no, Tom, you don't know what you're doing, that kind of thing. And Colossus tearing up the road is all visually great. I love Rachel actually doing the right thing. She's using her telekinesis to stop the rubble that's falling from hurting the innocent citizens, which is exactly what they should be doing. You get Nightcrawler bamfing all around Black Tom and punching him, which is just, it's one of my favorite things always to see, is multiple, you know, echo images of Nightcrawler bamfing around somebody and punching him. I love that stuff. And then Rogue does the cool thing, which you're about to describe.
Take her gloves off and touch Black Tom, and she becomes Jugger Rogue.
Oh, God.
Basically, she's transferring all the power of that Black Tom has from the jewel. She becomes tall and big and as big as Juggernaut. She's sharing the power of Juggernaut while Black Tom has shrunk back down. Now, this is going to be a pretty clever way to make this not a permanent change.
Right.
For Black Tom.
I agree.
Right? Now she's fighting Juggernaut. Good pose. He's still too tough. You know, Rachel can't use her telepathy against him because of that helmet. Rogue rips it right off.
Colossus does.
Yeah. She tries to, but she can't get a grip. Colossus does it. And there's the other helmet under the big helmet.
That was actually pretty clever on Juggernaut's behalf, because he's always getting his helmet ripped off. So why not build on an under helmet? So I will say also on that same page, when Rachel tries to mind blast him with the under helmet, that's a pretty... Now, I don't know whether he's taking that from someone else's design, but the concentric rings around Rachel as she blasts him and stuff, it just looks really cool. A drawing, good effect for a mental blast.
He's unstoppable. He's the Juggernaut. So even mentally, they can't stop him. So Rogue reaches up. You know, he's like holding her by the shirt or something. And she reaches up and touches him. And she shrinks him back down. Now she's a full Juggernaut. having flashbacks of Juggernaut's whole history. She's crazed. She becomes like a rhino type character, barreling into buildings. She's causing more destruction.
She's Kane Marco at this point. And so she is very pointedly after Spider-Man because he's ruined everything. And she's mad at Charles Xavier. So I think she's just living through Kane's thoughts.
Yeah, it's Juggernaut's rage that takes her over. But it doesn't last long, crying at the end of this. And the Juggernaut has grabbed the Jewel of Sitarak again, and he's become full Juggernaut, and he's not going to share this power anymore, so he throws the Jewel into orbit.
As you do.
So no one else will ever touch it. So that's pretty smart.
It is pretty smart on his part. I also, going back a little bit, I want to say I really liked the storytelling aspect of Rogue being overwhelmed by the Kane Marco mental process, and then the way she loses the Kane power is he's grabbing the stone. I think is what made her lose the power so quickly, I think.
Right, because she never touched the stone, so it's like it can't stay with her.
Yeah.
And, I mean, being overwhelmed is a thing. I mean, at this point, Rogue is partly Carol Danvers.
Yep.
So she's Ms. Marvel, Captain Marvel, or, you know, as well as herself. So that's become a merged personality because she used her power too much on that one heroine. While they're reacting to this, you just hear a crash, and in between the panels, the villains have escaped through the sewers. It's a little anticlimactic, am I right?
Well, it's so stupid. I mean, they didn't so much escape from the sewers as they've gone down to the sewers. Then the heroes actively choose to let them escape. They're like, I'm not going down there. I mean, you know, I don't want to go in the sewer. Do you want to go in the sewer? Nah, it'll probably wreck the sewer. Yeah, we don't want to wreck the sewer. Just let him go. It's the freaking Juggernaut, bitch. You need to go get him.
Do we? I get it. I mean, like, these five heroes have not been able to put a dent in Juggernaut without massive destruction.
True.
Do we want to do that in the Undercity? It's like, leave them to the Morlocks.
Just know, every person they kill from then on is your fault.
Oh, God.
That's more of a 1990s DC thing, but anyway.
But, I mean, in a way, you know, would Spider-Man do this? This is exactly how he got his Uncle Ben killed.
Ooh, good point. Yes.
So, of course, the cops are coming, and the X-Men aren't exactly not on a wanted list. You know, at this point, they're fighting Freedom Force, and so they're wanted by the feds. So they escape. So does Spider-Man. The cops are just going, what? There's one cop trying to grab Rachel, just reaching for her.
And of all the people there, why Rachel's the one who's dressed like a normal teenager. Like, right. Why would you assume Rachel had anything to do with any of this?
Right. She could just be a civilian.
Everyone else is wearing super costumes.
Leave the cops in the dust. I mean, there's massive damage. Somebody has to answer for that. But it's not going to be these five. We go to the Daily Planet.
Do we go to the Daily Planet? We go to the Daily Bugle.
Well, it just says Daily on the panel. So, an honest mistake.
You got Superman on the mind.
Right, exactly. Peter Parker goes into the dark room to develop his pictures, and they're ruined. I will call bullshit on some of this. The camera falls. Mm-hmm. Okay, is that what broke the camera? That doesn't necessarily expose the film. Did it?
But also says it's all gunked with web fluid as well.
This is what he says, is it must have been when I dropped the camera and I webbed it back up. That's when I gunked up the works. Well, you know, there's still all the pictures of Black Tom and Juggernaut fighting that was before reaching for, I don't know. It's like, would it have done this? Regardless, it's ruined the whole film. So he has no pictures for that. But he also developed the pictures of the girls on the rooftop, which were on a different film roll, I would imagine.
Oh, see, okay, if it was a different film role, then that would make sense. By the way, it's not just girls on rooftop. It's the girls in the bikinis. That's what's the critical part there.
I'm sure the rooftop, that has nothing to do with it, right?
Well, I'm just saying, you should mention that, because that's the whole reason they use the photos, is because the girls,
yes,
in bikinis.
There's a summer spread that they want to do in the paper. They lost their own pictures for it. The negatives were damaged.
Yep.
Okay, so everybody's losing pictures today.
And if you think about it, like, kids today would have no idea how film works, so we could just say whatever we want and say, oh, that's how cameras worked back then. And they'd be like, oh, okay.
Okay. So Peter Parker is going to sell those pictures, just get releases from the girls. They'll probably get paid as well, to pay it for everybody. And so that's our happy ending.
You don't know it because it doesn't say the end, but that is, in fact, where the comic stops. Yeah.
Also, the big Peter Parker face does spell the end, right? It just feels like an end panel.
It's a terrible face, though. I would say overall, the whole plot, if you look at the issue as a whole, I mean, it's not deep. It's silly. Boils down to Juggernaut wants to give his best friend a gift, and it causes complete chaos, and they destroy half the city, and the bad guys don't even get stopped. But it does give us enough of an excuse for a lot of fun character moments. So it's a fun comic. I enjoy it.
The same. I think it sort of abruptly stops. They don't really resolve that fight. They just have the villains escape.
Yep.
So it's just going to be, okay. But I kind of like the buddy story between two villains.
Sure. Yeah. No, that's true.
And that it's a gift that went wrong. You know, it just got you the wrong gift and it causes mayhem. And the heroes kind of get involved in that. I almost feel like we're going to ask later, is this more of an X-Men story or a Spider-Man story? That's me imitating me. But really, it's kind of a Juggernaut Black Tom story. You know, it's like, well, it's kind of their palling around that causes all this. And I'm more interested in their relationship than anything else.
Well, it's a fun moment in there, too, because as they're walking away, they've walked out of camera, off panel, and you hear Black Tom's voice from off panel, like, he's just shooting the breeze now. Like, he wanted to kill Juggernaut 15 minutes ago. Now it's like, oh, Kane, did you see the look on Colossus's face when I ripped the street out from under him? Oh, what a, like, they're so happy about it. They just had a great time. It was like the best birthday ever.
And everything's forgiven about all the things that went wrong. Yeah.
So I got a question for you. So this is the final issue of Marvel Team Up, right? And I would argue that in the 1970s and 1980s, Marvel Team Up was the most successful of the Team Up books, even more so than Marvel 2-in-1 or Brave and the Bold and DC Comics Presents. And before all you DC Comics fans get mad at me, I have evidence of this. At least as of 1981, we found some numbers. And sure enough, yes, Marvel Team Up did far outsell the other books. Now, if you go back to like maybe 78, 79, maybe not so much, I don't know. But around 1981, at least I can tell you that Marvel Team Up was the top selling one. So my question for you is, has there ever been another monthly Team Up book since then that was as successful as Marvel Team Up?
No. Comics have been selling less generally.
True.
You know, of course, there's like the peak 90s, speculator market stuff where the millions of copies of things. But there weren't any real monthly, you know, there's been a Spider-Man team up that Marvel has put out. Obviously, there's a miniseries, like recently there's been like It's Clobbering Time, which was a new Marvel 2-in-1, but just like a 5-issue miniseries. It's kind of like that. DC had the Brave and the Bold coming back, but not Batman every month. So it's like different team ups every time.
Yeah. Yeah, that was the Mark Waid, George Perez, and J. Michael Straczynski run. That's the closest I could think of a long-term, not miniseries team-up book that was successful. Now, I would say it's nowhere nearly as successful as Marvel Team-Up was, but I mean, that's the closest I can think as being.
I mean, unless Spider-Man Team-Up did well, you know, in terms of numbers, which is quite possible, started with a Spider-Man Red Hulk 4-issue, but it was like multiple issues for each team up, right, by that time. So it just doesn't feel the same. To me, the show is right now celebrating the Bronze Age team up books, and it really is the golden age, so to speak, of team up books.
Yeah.
There's never been like another era where team up books were a thing. They've never done it as well or in the same way. I love the early issues of that Brave and the Bold series that we're talking about, but it's still, I can't imagine it would do as well as something like Marvel Team Up back in the day.
The Brave and the Bold from the 60s might have, simply because comics were selling so many more copies at that point, but it was the only Team Up book on the shelf.
Right. You know, back when Neil Adams was drawing it, late 60s, early 70s, it might have sold more than...
But once the Marvel books are on the shelf and it's Marvel versus DC at that point, Marvel's outselling them every time.
All right, who fared better, Shag? How well, first, does this story fit the stories or atmospheres of the characters? Is this a Spider-Man story, or is it more of an X-Men story? I promised you I was going to ask this question, so here it is.
Well, you've already said it. I mean, it's a Juggernaut Black Tom story, really. But
I mean, it's X-Men villains.
That's true. Well, a Juggernaut's also a Spider-Man villain at this point, to some extent.
Juggernaut's somebody who's like fought a lot of different people.
Yep.
Where do you put this?
I think it's mostly Spider-Man. Because, like, you know, the X-Men are actively only with Spider-Man in the battle for 10 pages. So it's 25% of the book. That's it. So I feel like it's more of a Spider-Man story. Even though, I'm sticking to my guns.
No, I think you're right. Like, he's got the subplot that gets resolved. He's got many more pages. Okay, let's talk cool moves. Spider-Man's coolest move. For me, it's got to be the bit where Juggernaut charges into the wide net of web, stretches it taut, and Spidey uses a web line to trip him up. and then he slingshots back into Black Tom. That has to be the best move for Spidey.
Oh, there's no denying it. Absolutely, that's the best Spider-Man move. So, like, I tried to go through and find other cool moves, and that one just totally crushes it. So, since you picked that one, I'll pick Peter taking pictures of bikini-clad girls in exchange for free food. That's pretty smart.
What about the X-Men? Like, for me, Rogue is obviously the MVP here, but they each get the little moments.
Yeah, once again, no argument. Rogue's absolutely the character to watch this time, right? But I mentioned earlier, Rachel stopping the debris from crashing down on the innocent bystanders is great. Nightcrawler bamfing around Black Tom, I like those. But yeah, I mean, I can't argue with Rogue, without a doubt.
What about the opposite? Dumb or weird moves? Spider-Man's?
I would say it's both Spider-Man and the X-Men. Their dumb move is just letting Juggernaut and Black Tom escape in the sewers. Just like standing around the hole in the ground. I don't want to go in. Do you want to go in? I don't want to go in. Yeah, I think that was dumb.
Yeah, after so many years, I'm also going to call out the ruining his own photos. You would think at this point he'd have that down, but yeah, mistakes are going to happen. What about the X-Men?
The X-Men's dumb move is waiting until page 27 to join the fight. So, no.
Granted.
Maybe that's on the writer. I don't know. Whatever.
If I'm going to say Rogue is the best X-Men here, I think Rachel is the weak link. She hesitates too long. She never uses her telekinesis, you know, against the villains. Like, yeah. She's just like shooting telepathic blasts that don't work. But you do have that telekinesis, girl. You've used it. We've seen it in other contexts. And just not using it against Juggernaut, like, make him float in the air or something so he can't run, which is most of his power, is like charging people.
Anyway. Yeah.
What about the friendly farewell? It is a team-up tradition. They hear police sirens. They take off in different directions since the X-Men are currently federal fugitives. But Colossus calls him my friend, waves at him as he leaves. So how friendly is this?
Oh, it's extreme. I mean, even more so, right before that, before the sirens show up, you know, Colossus and Spider-Man are literally shaking hands. And they're very friendly. They're complimenting each other. It's the Mutual Admiration Society, without a doubt. Very friendly farewell.
Did they bond on Secret Wars? Or?
I'll talk about that in a minute.
Okay. Interesting. Final question. If this were your first X-Men story, would you seek out more? Did Marvel Team Up do its job of like drawing you to the book that you should already be reading?
I think so. I mean, Rogue is especially interesting in this, I think. Rachel has enough angst to at least attract attention. So yeah, I think it did a good job.
Yeah, if you know the X-Men a little bit already, but you haven't read it recently and you're thinking, who is this Rachel Summers person? You know, maybe that would be interesting. I think it works for me. Rogue always leaves an impression. I kind of love heroes with variable powers. It's kind of my thing. For some reason. And they do seem to have a lot of stuff going on, right? So, you know, you won't get bored if you check out their comic.
Interesting, though, too, because none of these four are really the headliners of the book. These are all more, I don't want to say background characters, but it's not Cyclops or Storm leading the team. It's not Wolverine. It's not Kitty, who's a big focus of the team. It's the more minor characters, and yet they still were enough to pique our interest.
All right, we'll take a break for a couple of promos, and then we'll be back with our special features.
A long time ago, in a comic book rack far, far away. During the years between The Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, Marvel Comics kept the Star Wars magic alive, delivering bold new stories, expanding the mythology, and taking our favorite heroes and villains on unforgettable adventures. Now join me, the irredeemable Shag, and an ever-changing roster of guest hosts as we journey back to this incredible era. We begin with a comic adaptation of The Empire Strikes Back and continue through the thrilling tales leading up to Return of the Jedi. If you're a seasoned Star Wars veteran who knows your Shira Bree from your hoojibs, or a brave explorer venturing into these comics for the first time, this is your hyperspace lane to classic Star Wars adventure. Join us for Marvel Star Wars, From Empire to Jedi, every other month on the Fire & Water Podcast Network.
Coming soon from Amalgam Comics, JL Avengers relaunches with a new number one issue following the destruction of X-World at Ronian hands in the instant classic 100th issue. Stepping through the Absorbiscon Perilous, the team has been reincarnated as Native American avatars, and as leader, Hawk Angel's first order of business is dealing with the Morlocks of the Netherworld. The Phoenix Spawn Saga begins, and our heroes will never be the same again. Only from Amalgam. We're back and we're caught in the web. It's the feature where we discuss some of our favorite interactions between Spider-Man and his guest, or guests in this case, outside of the comic we just featured. Shag?
So you asked me a minute ago about Secret Wars. In Secret Wars issue number 3, which was the second issue I bought really as a comic collector, a superhero comic collector, is Spider-Man versus the X-Men. It's right on the cover. Spider-Man ends up defeating the X-Men. I remember all kinds of people complaining and having a fit saying the X-Men should have won, they're more powerful, whatever. But I mean, first of all, Spider-Man won because comics. And also, Peter Parker and the X-Men both have terrible luck. Everything goes wrong for them. So the fight really could have gone either way. In fact, in this issue, when the X-Men first show up, Spider-Man says, "The X-Men? Swell. They're just what I need. All I know is these unpredictable egomaniacs will side with the villains." Because in Secret Wars number 3, and they even give you a footnote, so Spider remembers a recent misunderstanding during Secret Wars, that he thought the X-Men were going to team up with Magneto. And so he went to go fight them because he felt like the X-Men were betraying them. So I do like that they sort of continue that thread of Spider-Man not necessarily trusting the X-Men here.
By the end, it's like they repaired that bridge.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. For me, I mean, it's actually a story you mentioned earlier. It's Uncanny X-Men 190-191, the Kulan Gath story.
Woohoo!
Kind of what I said about Age of Revelation, in a way, it tickles my interests in what-ifs and else-worlds. And it's like New York is it's like a piece of Cimmeria, you know, essentially. Everybody's transformed. I love to discover the X-Men's Conan the Barbarian fantasy looks. And meanwhile, Spider-Man is still himself, because anyone who met Kulan Gath already, like Spidey and met him in the Red Sonja issue of Marvel Team-Up. So there, he's not affected by the spell. And his best bit is that he continues to mock the villain, even while he's being tortured, doing the banter. And in fact, doesn't he die in that reality?
Oh, yeah. He's murdered. Yeah.
It's a whopper with some beautiful John Romita Jr. art. I think in his prime, you know, like he would later do Spider-Man, but I didn't like it as much. This is like his best era for me. And it was just like a very cool story with Spider-Man kind of at the center of it, even though it was an X-Men story.
Those two issues are fantastic. Claremont packed like 25 pounds of story in this 2-issue pound bag. There's so much story in there that he packed in there. And it's a blast. All the Elseworld stuff, you could sit there. I mean, that literally could have been a 12-issue series, just that story. And mm-hmm. He would have never run out of things to talk about. It was so fascinating.
All right. Bonus team up. It's our final feature in which each of us proposes a perfect X-Men team up. They've had many. Let's see what you came up with.
Oh, you're going to laugh at me. 1980s Uncanny X-Men team up with the 1980s Justice League Detroit. Because the X-Men are the heroes that the general public don't trust, right? And the Justice League Detroit are the heroes that no one believes in. So they're both, you know, pariahs, if you will. So imagine it, written by Chris Claremont with art by Chuck Patton. Just imagine what Claremont could have done with the Justice League Detroit personalities, especially the newbies, right, and their powers, or what Chuck Patton's pencil could do for drawing the X-Men. I mean, this thing would have been glorious, right? Here's kind of the story I came up with. So Earth is facing another alien invasion from the Shi'ar, you know, of course, led by Deathbird. But this time, they've teamed up with Despero. So the X-Men end up with unexpected allies in the Justice League. And rather than battling each other like usual, they end up becoming friends. You get Colossus and Steel. At first, they don't really trust each other because their own each individual patriotisms. But eventually, they discover the similarities in their powers. And they build this mutual respect. And then you get scenes with Wolverine and Vixen, like, stalking through the woods, searching for some, like, I don't know, Shi'ar scouting team or whatever. And, like, their tracking abilities and the animalistic nature and all that. It makes them the perfect pair. I can just envision all kinds of sexual tension between Wolverine and Vixen. Then, and this is going to be one of those X-Men adventures where Banshee's hanging around for whatever reason, maybe because Moira was around. I don't know. He would show up from time to time. Anyway, in this story, Banshee and Vibe are constantly bickering. They just clash and clash and clash until in battle, they realize their powers of sound and vibration complement each other. And to be fun, both of them have terribly written accents, so no one can understand a word either one of them are saying. Then finally, you get Kitty Pryde and Gypsy instantly become best friends forever. And together, you know, when they share their powers, they can walk through walls and turn invisible. They become the perfect espionage team. And then, of course, the rest of the team members are going to gel well, and they work together somehow, end up defeating Deathbird and Despero. That's not my job. That's the writer's job to figure out. And I think it'd be a lot of fun.
You sold it well.
What about you, man?
Very good matchups between each of these characters. I thought up something just for you, Shag.
Oh, noes!
Yes, the X-Men and the Rebels from V. I mean, I think the political overtones of each series.
I'm sold already. You can stop there.
So the visitors show up. They want to harvest mutants because consuming them gives them powers.
Oh, wow.
So you get superpowered visitors using their own version of the Sentinels. And the Star Child is really the Phoenix, you know, something.
Oh, my gosh.
We can do something with the Star Child.
So wait, like, which people got eaten by the visitors?
Well, maybe it's like, you know, the random mutants that we don't care about. But also, it's like an Elseworlds, right? We can eat mutants that we love.
Toad. No one likes Toad. That is incredible. And I love it. And I can see the art style from the V comic book coming through. Oh, I'm in love with this, Siskoid. Thank you. You've made my night.
Okay, now it's time for web zingers of our own, which is to say your feedback on our previous episode together, in which we covered Marvel Team Up number 149, starring Spider-Man and Cannonball.
All right, now listen up, true believers. Remember, the comments section of the Marvel Team Up episodes is very important, because last time, with the Cannonball issue, it was a rocketing success, right? And the FW Team Up episode had the most comments for that cycle, so that's fantastic, and the most individual people commenting, because that's our goal. We want to get as many comments as we can on Fire and Water Team Up, specifically for Marvel Team Up, because we want to show people that Spider-Man is the best character in the Team Up cycle. So you people, you came through. You folks are amazing. You folks are spectacular. You people are even web of. Now, it is time to keep this wall-crawling momentum swinging, folks. So let's show the world. Again, Marvel Team Up was the most popular Team Up comic, as we've established, and the Spider-Man fans are the best. So please share your thoughts at Fire and Water Podcast Network for this episode, Webheads, and let's keep the comments flowing and keep Marvel Team Up on top. Because remember, with great podcasts comes great participation.
Okay, why don't you start us off, Shaq?
All right, we're from Movie Matt Sorois. He says, hey, gents, great episode as always. Well, thank you, Matt. I appreciate that. And he says, I'm surprised Marvel hasn't rewritten and expanded the story of Marvel Team Up number 149 into a multi-part crossover event. Think of it. Sam Guthrie's gift to his mother being tossed around the Marvel Universe as heroes and villains alike scrambled to possess it. All because it's the perfect accessory to the Infinity Gauntlet. Of course, he's talking about the hat, by the way, that Cannonball had bought last issue. The universe trembles as Silver Surfer and the Guardians of the Galaxy carry it to a distant world in hopes of hiding it forever. All is nearly lost when Mephisto uses trickery to gain control of the hat, only to face defeat when he realizes he does not have the right shoes to go with it. Thank you, Matt. I love it.
A story waiting to be told. Buggy749 puts Cannonball in the Milestone universe for his bonus team up. A story that involves a D&D session. Anyway, check the whole thing out in the comments at fireandwaterpodcast.com. While Ange offers Cannonball teaming up with Bouncing Boy, which might be a fun crossover with Cannonball acting like a pool stick to shoot Chuck all over the world.
Oh, or like a pinball machine, like pew.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. They were from Mark Baker Wright. Specifically, we talked about Cannonball being thrown by the sales tax when he was buying the hat. And Mark says, no prize time. Having grown up in Kentucky, I can verify that the state is somewhat noteworthy for its extremely low income tax. More so at the time the comic was published than today. Conversely, New York City sales tax are pretty high. So let's stipulate that Sam is able to more or less ignore Kentucky negligible sales tax and hardly ever has to think about it, even with his meager funds, but had a rude awakening when confronted in the reality of New York City. It's a decent no prize, Mark. I appreciate it. Chris Franklin chimes in, of course, a citizen of Kentucky, and says, just for reference, Kentucky sales tax has been 6% for decades now. I think it was 5% when I was young, so that is pretty low. All right, there we go.
Yeah. Paul Kien says, fun episode. Discussion better than the comic for sure. I always liked Cannonball. He was such an aw shucks kind of guy who, I agree, matured over the years.
Then we're here from Tim Price, who talks a little bit about Brett Blevins, who's the artist, and he talks about how he read the epic comic series line The Boz Chronicles that Blevins had done. And he says, Blevins does make the leading lady in The Boz Chronicles very curvaceous. It's one of his hallmarks. So the Pegasus agent, a woman's portrayal, is actually pretty mild for Blevins. Because we were basically saying that it looked like her clothes had been spray painted on. So yeah. He says, the whole hat gag reminds me of Amazing Spider-Man Annual number 19, where Alistair Smythe happened to snag a hat box Spidey was carrying around as a gift for Aunt May. He low-jacked it to track Spider-Man down later, and when Smythe attacked, Mary Jane was wearing the hat, so Alistair jumps to the reasonable conclusion that MJ is actually Spider-Man. Oh, comics, you so crazy. And then he proposes his own cannonball team up, where he says maybe on a trip home to Kentucky, Independent Sam takes the bus, but he misses a transfer and ends up hitchhiking, where he's picked up by a suave Burt Reynolds, who's in the middle of a cross-country streetcar race, and Sam desperately wants to get out of it without revealing his powers. It could be called Cannonball's Run.
Yeah. I rewatched Cannonball Run recently.
Really? Was it terrible or was it good?
It wasn't a good idea, no.
Oh, no!
Gene Hendricks, because we mentioned the Pegasus Project, says, I have been summoned. Indeed. He says, you're right, Siskoid. This is the one and only appearance of the Incandescent Man, or even any mention of him. As the mission of Project Pegasus is to research alternative energy sources, it's right in the name, Potential Energy Group / Alternate Sources / United States Pegasus. Something like this creature coming out of it would make sense. Yes, of course. But yeah, it's its only appearance.
It makes more sense than that acronym.
For sure.
Then we heard from Lizanne Oswald. She says, I like that Brett Blevins drew this. He was the reason I first picked up Sleepwalker. I didn't realize Blevins drew Sleepwalker, but now when I think of Sleepwalker, it makes perfect sense. Liz says, the stories are what made me stay, but I liked Brett since New Mutants, and I only briefly read the Bird Brain story. Luckily, I missed that part. Yes, Liz, you're very lucky you missed the Bird Brain New Mutants issues.
Then we have Sean Ross says, great episode, guys. Cannonball's my favorite mutant. Oh, wow. And one of my all-time favorite characters. And this issue is part of the reason why. As a kid, I really related to Sam's struggles with his powers, especially when related to his peers. The move he pulls in this issue, where he cuts his blastin' midstream in order to change directions, is right out of New Mutants Annual Number 1, which is one of my favorite stories. It introduces Lila Cheney.
Rockstar, teleporter, cool girl.
We got to see him grow up on the page and have followed him to great heights. My only real issue is the hat itself. It is hideous. Does Sam hate his poor mother? Now she has to pretend to like this and wear it to church, where all the other church buddies will smirk behind her back. Poor Mama Guthrie. And we didn't really mention it, but like Peter in this issue that we covered today wants to buy the same hat.
Yes,
for
he does.
Aunt May, you know, so these boys don't have taste.
I imagine Aunt May's closet is full of hats that Peter's bought her that she's never worn. It's probably what it is. By the way, I just want to go back to Sean Ross says that he could relate to Sam's struggles with his powers. So is Sean Ross saying he had trouble with his blasting as a kid too? Is that what he's trying to say there? I don't know.
Didn't we all?
Then we're from Chris Pine. I'm not touching that.
don't touch it.
Who says, God, make it stop. He says, Marvel team up Spider-Man Thor. Really in my wheelhouse of the Marvel team up with these issues. I am not the biggest Milgram fan, but I like that cover a lot. I also like the Thor and Spider-Man relationship. Thor always comes across like the older brother who acts impressed that his little brother did a single pull-up, even though he can do 100. Aww, that's actually very accurate. I like that. That's really nice. Then he says, I will say that I did not love the Web of Spider-Man slander. That nope. Series has some fantastic covers. I love the local hero two-part story where Spider-Man encounters a small-town superhero. Pete does a lot of traveling for Now Magazine in that title, so we get some fun one-off stories with him in different locations. Hey, Chris, that is absolutely fair. And I want to say, you know, everyone is entitled to their own opinion. Even if you are the only one on the planet that loves Web of Spider-Man, that's okay, man. You do you, buddy.
I don't remember much about Web of Spider-Man or the ones that I've read, except that annual where he fights the slug.
I read a lot of Web of Spider-Man when we get to the Clone Saga, so I have no problem with Web of Spider-Man, actually. I just think it's a funny, you know, bit to keep going with. So let's see. Oh, I commented on the line, Spider-Man, when he sees Cannonball go by, he says, I'd recognize those ears anywhere. I talked about that line, and I couldn't remember where I read it. That's what it was. I couldn't remember where I read it, and I was asking the people at home to tell me if they remember where that line came from. And he chimes in to say, it comes from the X-Men, exactly the issues you and I have been talking about, Siskoid, the Kulan Goth stories. And Chris Pine points out that he goes, Shag, that's the story you and I covered together on Once Upon a Geek. Glad to see I left a lasting impression. Chris, it's not so much that. It's that one thing you'll learn about podcasting, Chris, is that literally the moment you finish saying something, it's out of your head and you forgot you said it on a podcast until someone comes back at you and tells you you did. It's just the nature of recording multiple podcasts a month or week for that matter, and it's just part of the deal.
You surprise yourself at the editing stage. So.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for clarifying that, and I had a blast recording that X-Men episode with you, Chris. You know that. It was so much fun. Then I also want to give credit to Movie Matt Royce because he also identified the quote. So good job, y'all. I'm impressed. And that issue just keeps coming. X-Men 190 and 191 just keeps coming back into the conversation.
Thanks for all your comments, guys. And thanks for teaming up with me, Shag. bag. Maybe you should tell people what else you're working on at the moment.
Sure.
You know, let's not rest on our laurels with your episode on X-Men 190, 191. You've got more stuff coming.
Here's a whole bunch of other podcasts that when I say these things, I'll forget what I said. Okay. So JSA in the 90s is my monthly deep dive into the Justice Society of America as published in the 1990s. We've just recently wrapped up the 10-issue series from the 1990s by Mike Parabek, and we're about to move into the 8-issue limited series drawn by a variety of artists who go on to do the Impact comics. Then my every other month podcast is entitled Marvel Star Wars from Empire to Jedi. And those cover the classic 1980 Star Wars comics. And we just finished Empire Strikes Back, and we're now covering the issues that come after that. And then there's Once Upon a Geek, which is a podcast where I cover a variety of topics. It's also an every other month show, including my occasional coverage of the Blue Devil comic series. And then we've got another Who's Who review episode coming out soon, and you can always find me on the social media under Once Upon a Geek.
All right. A reminder that we do have a Patreon, so if you like this content, want more like it, please think about making a monthly or a one-time donation, the amount of which will allow you to unlock rewards. Check it out at patreon.com/FWPodcasts. This month, we're proud to team up with our sponsor, Alan W. Wright, the Bold Outlaw. And we do enjoy reading your thoughts. I think Shag made that clear. The best place for that is fireandwaterpodcast.com. We'll read your comments on this issue when Shag is back with us. But next month, I'll be here with our friend Chris Franklin as we tackle Brave and the Bold, number 164.
And I'll be back in 4 months with another issue of Marvel Team-Up we'll be covering in... Oh, wait a minute. This was the last issue. So what are we doing next?
Well, we've been talking about this for a while. We're going back in time to the popular Chris Claremont, John Byrne issues.
Woohoo!
So that particular pairing of creators, you know, Claremont wrote some without Byrne on the art, and Byrne drew some without Claremont writing. We're skipping all of that and just giving you their collaborations. And that starts with Spider-Man, Yellow Jacket, and the Wasp in Marvel Team-Up number 59.
All right, can't wait.
So on that, see you next time for another amazing superhero team-up, because after all, justice
is a team effort.